This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Cindy, and this is the New York Times News Hour for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. Our first article of the day is Iran moves to project stability after crash kills key leaders. The Ayatollah announced 5 days of mourning for the president and foreign minister, who died when their helicopter plunged into a mountainous region. Some Iranians celebrated the deaths. This article is by Farnaz Fasihi, Vivian Yi, and Leila Nikunazar. Iran sought to project a sense of order and control on Monday by quickly naming an acting president and foreign minister a day after a helicopter crash killed both leaders. The change in leadership came at a time of heightened tensions in the Middle East and domestic discontent in Iran, where many residents have called for an end to decades of repressive clerical rule. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, announced 5 days of mourning for the president, Ebrahim Raisi, 63, and the foreign minister, Hossein Ammar Abdollahian, 60, who died when their helicopter plunged into a mountainous area near the Iranian city of Jolfa. The men had been returning from Iran's border with Azerbaijan after inaugurating a joint dam project. Iran's armed forces said they had created a committee to investigate the crash, which state media attributed to a technical failure. Mr. Raisi, a hardline cleric who came of age during the country's Islamic Revolution, oversaw a deadly crackdown on protesters as the head of the judiciary in 2019 and as president in 2022. He had been widely viewed as a possible successor to Ayatollah Khamenei, 85. On Monday, Ayatollah Khamenei named Iran's first vice president, Mohammad Mokhbar, acting president and announced that Mr. Mokhbar would organize elections for a new president within 50 days. A conservative political operative, Mr. Mokhbar has a long history of involvement in large business conglomerates closely tied to Ayatollah Khamenei. Iran's cabinet appointed Ali Bagheri Khani, a deputy foreign minister, as the ministry's caretaker, the IRNA state news agency reported. Mr. Bagheri Khani has served as Iran's chief nuclear negotiator and was involved in a deal last year that freed imprisoned Americans in exchange for several jailed Iranians and eventual access to about $6 billion in Iranian funds. Iranian officials said there would be a public procession in Tabriz, the closest big city to the site of the crash, on Tuesday, and that the bodies would then be brought to Tehran for a state funeral. Some Iranians mourned Mr. Raisi, including people who held an overnight vigil in his hometown, Mashhad, in northern Iran. State media also showed images of vigils in Tehran and many other cities. Raisi was tireless, Ayatollah Khamenei said in a statement. In this very sad incident, the people of Iran have lost a valuable and loyal public servant. Muhammad Ali Ahangaran, a prominent religious scholar in Tehran, said in a telephone interview that he had cried for hours when he heard the news and said that although he had once campaigned against Mr. Raisi, the death of a president was a somber moment for the nation. Analysts in Iran said that while there was speculation about who might be elected as the next president, there was little question about the overall stability of the country or the government. They pointed out that Ayatollah Khamenei will remain supreme leader with power over major state policies. The deaths have shocked everybody, even the rival political factions have all come together to express solidarity, as is customary in Iranian culture when someone dies, says San Karimi, an adjunct professor and foreign policy researcher at the University of Tehran, said in a telephone interview. In reality, there will be no real power vacuum in Iran because the cabinet and the government is in place and functioning. Despite the officials' calls for mourning, many Iranians welcomed Mr. Raisi's death, seeing him as one of the key figures in a corrupt regime who oversaw the execution of dissidents, used brutal violence to suppress and kill protesters, and arrested journalists and activists. Many of the victims were women and young people. Over the last 2 years, anger at the government has also grown as Iran's currency has plunged to a record low. Water shortages have been intensified by climate change, and the country was hit by the deadliest terrorist attack since the Islamic Republic was founded in 1979. On social media, one widely circulated meme showed a helicopter being brought down by the braided hair of a young woman with her head uncovered. The image was a reference to the Woman Life Freedom protests that began in 2022, opposing a law that requires women to dress modestly and wear headscarves. All this humor is a bitter expression of the pain of a nation, said Safa, 55, a doctor in Mashhad, who, like other Iranians, asked to be identified only by her first name for fear of government retribution. Parisa, 55, who lives in Lahijan in northwestern Iran, said she had initially felt relief when she heard that the president and foreign minister had been killed in a helicopter crash. But after they were found, I thought this easy death wasn't enough for them, she said. They should have been tried in court and forced to howl like dogs and been given long and painful punishments. Many countries, including the United States, offered condolences after the crash. Iranian state television reported that President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, a close ally of Iran, had spoken to Mr. Mokhber and had offered Russia's assistance in full capacity. Turkey, Iraq, and the European Union said they had also offered help in search and recovery efforts at the crash site. John F. Kirby, a national security spokesman at the White House, said that the United States had offered its condolences, but added that we're going to continue to hold Iran accountable for all their destabilizing behavior in the region, which continues to this day. Last month, a long shadow war between Iran and Israel burst into the open with an exchange of direct strikes. Two Iran-backed militias, Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Hezbollah in Lebanon, continue to battle Israeli forces, and the future of Iran's nuclear program looms over the Middle East. The country has produced nuclear fuel enriched to a level just short of what would be needed to produce several bombs. In Israel, Mr. Raisi was perceived as a figurehead who had little influence on foreign policy or Iran's support for Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis in Yemen. From Israel's point of view, I don't see any achievement in his being replaced by some other radical conservative Iranian, said Seema Shein, an analyst at the Institute for National Security Studies, a research group in Tel Aviv. The president is not the most important person in Iran. Analysts said Mr. Raisi's death could raise the prospects of the Ayatollah's son, Mojtaba Khamenei, succeeding him as supreme leader. A low-profile hardliner, he grew up among the clerical and political elite in Iran and has close ties with the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, a powerful Iranian military force. A growing number of leaders within Iran's political establishment have begun to publicly endorse him, said Arash Azizi, a lecturer at Clemson University who focuses on Iran. When people started talking about Mochaba as a potential successor in 2009, I considered it a cheap rumor, Dr. Azizi said. But it's not that anymore. It's very clear now that he is a remarkable figure, and he's remarkable because he's been almost entirely invisible in the public eye. Other Iran experts dismissed the idea that Mojtaba Khamenei could replace his father as supreme leader, saying it would upend the logic of Iran's system of government. For one, the son teaches at Iran's largest seminary, but he has not achieved a high rank within the Shiite clerical hierarchy, a qualification long seen as necessary for the role of supreme leader. Since the Islamic Revolution deposed the Shah in 1979, Iran has also proclaimed the end of hereditary rule as one of its foundational principles. If the supreme leader turns into a hereditary system, what does that mean? It means the system is dead, said Mohammad Ali Shabani, an Iran analyst and editor of Amwash, a news outlet based in Britain that focuses on Iran, Iraq, and the Arabian Peninsula. Until a successor is chosen, there will be intense jockeying for influence and power, analysts said, and ultimately, they said, the choice will be made from one within an opaque system that has only become less transparent in recent years. The reality is that nobody knows, Mr. Shabani said, and that is crazy. There is zero transparency on a process that affects millions of Iranians. Okay, so moving on to our next article. News analysis, aggression or caution, the choice facing Iran's next leaders. The question is whether the successors to the president and foreign minister will take a similar path by keeping slivers of communication open and avoiding direct conflict with the United States. This article is written by David E. Sanger, who has covered Iran's nuclear program and its challenge to the West for nearly 30 years. In their 3 years in power, President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran and his equally hardline foreign minister, Hossein Amer Abdollahian, I apologize if I am mispronouncing some of these names, did everything they could to consolidate the axis of resistance against the United States and Israel. They funded Hamas and Hezbollah. They armed the Houthis, feeding the militia intelligence that fueled attacks on cargo ships in the Red Sea. They cracked down on dissent at home, launched Iran's first direct missile attacks on Israel after Israel killed several Iranian generals, and turned Iran into a threshold nuclear state that could produce fuel for 3 or 4 bombs in short order. But for all those aggressive moves, the two men, both killed in helicopter crash in the mountain near Azerbaijan on Sunday, were also careful. Last week, days before their deaths, they approved talks with the United States through intermediaries aimed at making sure the war in Gaza was not the prelude to a wider war in the Middle East. And they stopped just short of making those bombs, at least as far as American intelligence agencies and international inspectors can determine. The question now is whether their successors, almost certain to be from the same hardline camp, American officials suspect, will show similar caution, and whether in the cauldron of internal Iranian power plays and an all-consuming presidential election in the United States, it will even be possible to keep up the sliver of communications between Washington and Tehran. The thing about Raisi was that he was the supreme leader's man, said Dennis Ross, the longtime Mideast negotiator, referring to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the 85-year-old head of state who has led the country since 1989. He allows engagement, but no compromise. His team will inflict damage, but keep it within bounds. They don't want a direct conflict with the U.S., which is the one thing that could threaten the regime, and I don't expect that to change. American officials say it is far too early to predict Mr. Raisi's successor, but that he is likely to be cast in the same mold. As one American official noted recently, in the eyes of the supreme leader, that approach may appear to be working. Iran has forged a new relationship with Russia as a critical supplier of drones and missiles, and its attack on Israel demonstrated a new ability to swarm weapons, even if most of Iran's drones and missiles were taken out by air defenses. Short as it was, the Raisi era turned resistance into the semblance of a strategy. A decade ago, it was possible to imagine a very different future for the United States and Iran. Mr. Raisi's predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, and his urban, Western-educated foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, seemed determined to dial back the decades of hostility and sanctions that had crippled Iran's economy. They talked about personal freedom and women's rights, courted European leaders, even while the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps kept funding terrorism. Mr. Zarif engaged directly with the Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, even triggering an uproar among Iranian conservatives when the two men were seen strolling together deep in conversation in Vienna. In a series of often volcanic negotiations, Mr. Zarif and Mr. Kerry emerged with an agreement that essentially swapped Iran's stockpile of nuclear fuel for sanctions relief. And while the country refused to give up its right to enrich uranium, it negotiated a complex series of limits on its activity that stretched to 2030. After that, Iran was free to produce as much nuclear fuel as it wanted, though it would still be prohibited as a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty from building atomic weapons. The deal, of course, quickly came under attack in the United States, especially in a Republican Congress, because it only delayed Iran's nuclear progress. It did not terminate its ability to cheat on the treaty. But it also proved enormously unpopular in Iran, especially after it turned out that the promised sanctions relief did not come as quickly or fully as promised. Big European banks and other financial institutions did not want to take the enormous financial risk of re-entering business agreements that could later run afoul of new sanctions, especially if relations with the West soured again. That is exactly what happened. President Donald J. Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018, and eventually so did the Iranians. Mr. Rouhani's reformists were frozen out of the supreme leader's inner circle, and when Mr. Rouhani's term ended, they were replaced by a new government that was openly dismissive of the nuclear agreement with the United States and the reformist agenda at home. Crackdowns on dissent followed. When Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken proposed a new nuclear arrangement, longer and stronger than the 2015 agreement, Mr. Amir Abdullahian shot the idea down. "We will not have a so-called longer and stronger deal," he told the New York Times in an interview in New York in 2021, where he was attending a United Nations meeting. "We will return to the negotiations and will do so very quickly," he said. "But if our counterparts don't change their behavior, we may not reach the required result." He was critical of the new American president, Joe Biden, for his paradoxical statements about relations with Iran and highly skeptical any middle ground could be found. Indeed, a new nuclear deal that seemed all but sealed in 2022 was killed in Tehran. Later, inspectors' access to nuclear sites was limited, and Iranian authorities dismantled cameras and other monitoring devices. Only last week, the Director General of International Atomic Energy Agency was in Tehran meeting with Mr. Amir Abdullahian about trying to win greater access to nuclear sites. He emerged without an agreement. And in the month before his death on Sunday, Mr. Amir Abdullahian expressed little interest in calming tensions over the war in Gaza, if the U.S. continues its military, political, and financial support of Israel and helps manage Israel's military attacks on Palestinian civilians, then it must face its consequences. Mr. Amir Abdullahian's deputy for political affairs, Ali Bagheri Khani, has been named caretaker of the foreign ministry. He is well known to American officials, and he led the Iranian delegations that have secretly and indirectly negotiated with the United States in Oman on at least three occasions over the past year. His appointment suggests that the supreme leader is interested in continuity. But, as one U.S. official noted on Monday, Washington's analysis over the past few years was focused on what would happen after the death of Ayatollah Khomeini, who was rumored to be ill. No one foresaw that, at age 85, he would be picking a new president. All right, so our next piece is entitled International Criminal Court Prosecutor Requests Warrants for Netanyahu and Hamas Leaders. While the request must be approved by the court's judges, the announcement is a harsh rebuke of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and his war strategy in Gaza. This article is written by Patrick Kingsley and Matthew Mepoke-Big. Patrick Kingsley reported from Jerusalem and Matthew McBoke-Big from London. The chief prosecutor of the world's top criminal court on Monday announced that he was seeking arrest warrants for the leaders of both Israel and Hamas on charges of crimes against humanity, a strong rebuke that equated Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel with his Hamas counterpart, Yahya Sinwar, and compounded the growing international alarm at Israel's conduct in Gaza. In a statement, Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, said that after investigating Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel and Israel's counterattack on Gaza, he had decided to apply for arrest warrants for Mr. Sinwar, Hamas's leader within Gaza. Mohammed Daif, Hamas's military leader, and Ismail Haniyeh, the movement's Qatar-based political leader. Mr. Khan also said he was requesting warrants for Mr. Netanyahu and for Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant. While Mr. Khan's request must still be approved by judges from the court, the announcement forms one of the harshest rebukes of Israel's strategy in its seven-month campaign against Hamas that has killed tens of thousands of Gazan civilians. It also heightens scrutiny of Hamas's actions at the start of the war in October, when Hamas fighters led a raid that killed more than 1,000 people and abducted hundreds more. Today, we once again underline that international law and the law of armed conflict apply to all, Mr. Khan said in his statement. No foot soldier, no commander, no civilian leader, no one can act with impunity. For now, the announcement is largely symbolic. Israel is not a member of the court and does not recognize its jurisdiction in Israel or Gaza, meaning that Israeli leaders would face no risk of arrest at home. Judges can also take months to uphold requests for arrest warrants, but if they do issue warrants, those named could be arrested if they travel to one of the court's 124 member nations, which include most European countries, but not the United States. Mr. Khan's decision to simultaneously pursue Israeli and Palestinian leaders was criticized by Israeli government ministers and Hamas alike. Both sides questioned why their allies had been targeted instead of their enemies alone. How dare you compare the monsters of Hamas to the soldiers of the Israeli army, the world's most moral military? Mr. Netanyahu asked in a statement on Monday evening. Similarly, Hamas said in a statement that it strongly denounces the attempt to equate the victim with the executioner by issuing arrest warrants against a number of Palestinian resistance leaders. The decision raised difficult questions for Israel's allies, who are members of the court and could be required to arrest Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant if the warrants are issued and the men subsequently travel to their territories. Qatar, which hosts several Hamas leaders, including Mr. Hanaya, is not a member of the court. President Biden condemned the move, saying in a statement that, "Whatever this prosecutor might imply, there is no equivalence, none, between Israel and Hamas." Mr. Khan's statement said that he had reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Sinwar, Mr. Daif, and Mr. Hanaya were responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including the killing of hundreds of Israeli civilians in attacks perpetrated by Hamas. Mr. Khan said he sought their arrest both for the killing of civilians and the capture of hostages during the October 7th attack, as well as on charges of maltreatment of and sexual violence against hostages during their captivity in Gaza. The requests for warrants were based on interviews with survivors, review of documentary evidence, including video and photographs, and field visits by Mr. Khan and his team. Mr. Khan visited the Israeli-occupied West Bank and a border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, but did not enter Gaza itself. He also went to some of the sites attacked in Israel during the Hamas-led raid, interviewing victims and witnesses. Regarding Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant, the prosecutor said he believed the Israeli leaders bore criminal responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including using starvation as a weapon of war and intentionally directing attacks against a civilian population. While Mr. Khan said that Israel was allowed to protect its citizens, he said that its forces had failed to uphold international law during its devastating response. Notwithstanding any military goals they may have, the means Israel chose to achieve them in Gaza, namely intentionally causing death, starvation, great suffering, and serious injury to body or health of the civilian population, are criminal, Mr. Khan wrote. Mr. Khan also implicitly criticized Israel's judicial system, saying that the ICC is forced to act only when a country's prosecutors fail to hold its own citizens to account. The court defers to national authorities only when they engage in the independent and impartial judicial processes that do not shield suspects and are not a sham, Mr. Khan said. But Antony J. Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said that Mr. Khan had not given Israel enough time to show that its own prosecutors were investigating the case. Mr. Blinken said that Mr. Khan's aides had called off a visit to Israel on Monday to address that very question, suggesting that they were not serious about finding out the answer. Mr. Khan's office said that it has not received any information that has demonstrated genuine action at the domestic level to address the crimes alleged or the individuals under investigation. Within the Israeli government, which has been split over disagreements about war strategy in recent days, the announcement prompted ministers to set aside their differences and adopt a united front. Benny Gantz, a minister in Israel's war cabinet and a critic of Mr. Netanyahu, accused the prosecutor of moral blindness in drawing an equivalence between the leaders of Israel and Hamas. Mr. Gantz's response came less than 2 days after he threatened to quit Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet for failing to set in motion a plan for the governance of post-war Gaza. Relatives of Israeli hostages praised the push to hold Hamas's leaders to account, but criticized the decision to target both Israeli politicians and Hamas's at the same time. The Hostage Families Forum, an alliance representing hostages, relatives, and supporters, said it applauds the issuance of warrants against senior Hamas officials, but was not comfortable with the equivalence drawn between Israel's leadership and the terrorists of Hamas. Palestinians in Gaza had the inverse reaction. questioning why Palestinian leaders had been targeted instead of only Israelis. Jaber Yahya, 50, a teacher in central Gaza, said by telephone that he was relieved to hear the requests for warrants for Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant. Then I found out there were other warrants against Anai, Sinwar, and Daif. Why do they insist on putting the killers and the victims in the same category? Appearing to anticipate such criticism from both sides, Mr. Khan wrote in his statement of the need to apply the law equally to all sides in conflict. If we do not demonstrate our willingness to apply the law equally, if it is seen as being applied selectively, we will be creating the conditions for its collapse, Mr. Khan said. In recent weeks, Israeli and Western officials had predicted privately and publicly that leaders from Israel and Hamas could soon face prosecution. In late April, Mr. Netanyahu said on social media that the country will never accept any attempt by the ICC to undermine its inherent right of self-defense. The ICC is the world's only permanent international court with the power to prosecute individuals accused of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. It is separate from the International Court of Justice, another international tribunal, in The Hague, which deals with disputes between states. The ICJ is currently assessing a claim brought by South Africa that Israel is conducting a genocide in Gaza, an accusation that Israel strongly denies. Mr. Biden, too, rejects that idea, stating flatly on Monday during a celebration of Jewish Heritage Month in the Rose Garden at the White House that Israel's military assault in Gaza in the wake of the October attacks led by Hamas is not genocide. We reject that, he said, telling an audience of Jewish leaders and activists that Americans stand with Israel. The ICC cannot try defendants in absentia, but its warrants can make international travel difficult. The court has no police force, relying instead on its members to make arrests. An arrested suspect is typically transferred to The Hague to appear before the court. Aid experts have said the hunger crisis in Gaza is a direct result of the war, as well as Israel's near-complete siege of the territory and its strikes on aid workers. The Israeli military said it had safely coordinated thousands of aid operations and that it was investigating any exceptional events that take place during war. More generally, Israel has denied placing limits on humanitarian aid entering the territory. It says Israeli officials have done all they can to bring food to the territory and that it is the fault of aid organizations for failing to adequately distribute food after the aid has crossed the border. Analysts have also cited Israel's failure to allow an alternative Palestinian leadership to take over in the territory, leading to a power vacuum and the breakdown of law and order, making it even harder to distribute food. The food situation in Gaza was considered stable before the war began, despite a 16-year blockade on the territory instigated by Israel and Egypt. But food supplies fell sharply in October when Israel cut off all aid deliveries for the 2 weeks that followed the Hamas attack. At that time, Mr. Gallant promised a total siege on the territory, describing Israel's attackers as human animals and promising no electricity, no food, no fuel for Gaza. Since reopening some aid routes in late October, Israeli officials have still imposed rigorous checks on aid going into Gaza, which is home to around 2.2 million people, and the prospect of famine has been looming for months. Mr. Khan cited several of these restrictions as justifications for issuing arrest warrants for Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Gallant, saying that they were part of a widespread and systematic attack against the Palestinian civilian population. By focusing on decisions by Israeli politicians, Mr. Khan avoided making detailed accusations about Israel's military leadership and did not discuss the actions of its air force or ground services forces. Okay, so moving on to our last headline for the day. We have how gun violence spread across one American city. Columbus, Ohio had only about 100 homicides a year. Then came a pandemic surge. With more guns and looser laws, can the city find its way back to the old normal? This article is by Sheila Dewan and Robert Jebeloff. Sheila Dewan reviewed police reports and court transcripts and visited the scenes of a dozen fatal shootings in Columbus. Robert Jebeloff analyzed the geographic pattern of more than 120,000 gun homicides in America between 2016 and 2023. The sequence of events that led to the killing of Jason Keyes was so confounding that friends and family did not quite believe it until they saw the video evidence played in court. Mr. Keyes and his wife, Sheree Williams Keyes, were getting into their car after a Father's Day visit in 2021 with her grandparents in a leafy neighborhood near Walnut Hill Park in Columbus, Ohio. A 72-year-old neighbor carrying a rifle accosted them in the belief, he later told police, that Mr. Keyes had let the air out of his daughter's tires and poisoned his lawn. Mr. Keyes, who was carrying a pistol in his waistband, and his father-in-law tried to disarm the man, knocking him to the ground, while another relative ran back inside to get a .22 rifle. While Ms. Keyes ducked behind the car to call 911, she heard multiple gunshots. She emerged to find her husband mortally wounded. It took a moment for everyone to realize that the shots had come from a fourth gun across the street. Elias Smith, a 24-year-old ex-Marine, had stepped to his front door with a so-called ghost gun, an AR-style rifle that Mr. Smith had assembled from parts ordered online. Within seconds, he opened fire, hitting Mr. Keyes 5 times. "What are you shooting for?" a relative of Mr. Keyes can be heard asking on surveillance video that captured parts of the incidents. Mr. Smith answered, "I don't know." It was an encounter emblematic of gun violence in America today, a dispute that might not have turned deadly but for firearms in increasingly easy reach. And it was an episode that exemplified a striking spread in fatal shootings nationwide since the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, a period in which Americans have purchased more guns, the Supreme Court has made them harder to regulate, and many states, including Ohio, have loosened restrictions on firearms. The block on the far east side of Columbus had been a haven with little, if any, gun violence. That kind of peace was what had drawn Ms. Keyes' grandparents to the area decades earlier, luring them from the center of the city to what promised to be a safer place to raise their family. And then, nearly 30 years after they had settled into a ranch house on Walnut Hill Park Drive, a burst of gunfire would take the life of Mr. Keyes, and with it, the neighborhood's sense of security. A New York Times analysis of fatal shootings across the country found that as the toll of gun violence rose during the pandemic, the carnage expanded its boundaries as well. Though gun violence remains highly concentrated, more than 47 million Americans lived within a 5-minute walk of a fatal shooting between 2020 and 2023, up from 39 million over the prior 4-year period. In Columbus, 41% of residents lived within a quarter mile of a fatal shooting, compared to 28% before the pandemic. The same spread of gun violence seen in Columbus took place in other cities, large and small. In Atlanta, 58% of residents lived near a fatal shooting during the pandemic years, up from 36% in the 4 years before 2020. In Minneapolis, half of its residents were exposed, up from a third. In Portland, Oregon, it was nearly 250,000 residents, up from 100,000. Every day across the country, there are dozens of deadly shootings that mostly do not rise to the level of national news, but still rend the fabric of a family, a block, a neighborhood, and, in the aggregate, American life. Anthony Pearson, a veteran prosecutor in Columbus, said that before COVID-19, he knew which neighborhoods to avoid. Now it feels like really no neighborhood is safe. Columbus has seen shootings at public parks and graduation parties, at a children's clothing shop, a Dairy Queen, a dollar store, and an upscale nightlife district called the Short North. At a water gun fight celebrating the start of summer, some people brought out real guns, killing a 17-year-old girl with a college scholarship. In 2021, the number of killings spiked to 207, unfathomable, in a city where most years saw closer to 100. Last year, there were 149. In Columbus, as elsewhere, the carnage has been marked by the involvement of conspicuously young people. Last June, two Columbus boys, 14 and 16, were charged in the shooting death of a girl in eighth grade. In August, a 13-year-old was arrested after a 15-year-old football player was killed near a Lululemon store at a popular shopping plaza. Columbus, a city considered so typically American that fast food chains use it as a test market, is far from alone in its troubles. In New Mexico last September, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham declared a state of emergency for Albuquerque after shootings claimed the lives of an 11-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a woman who confronted a group of teenagers in her stolen car. Louisville, Kentucky, calculated that gun homicides were costing the city $104 million a year in law enforcement, medical care, and lost tax revenue. Even though the tide of shootings and killings that washed across the country with the pandemic began to ebb last year, the improvement was uneven. Columbus closed out 2023 with more homicides than the year before, as did Dallas, Topeka, Kansas, Memphis, and Washington. There is optimism that 2024 is going to be better in Columbus, which has seen homicide numbers fall dramatically so far this year, with 36 as of last week, compared with 70 in the same period the year before. Gun violence nationwide is still higher than it was before the pandemic. The number of fatal shootings in the first quarter of 2024 was 13% higher than it was the same period in 2019, according to the Gun Violence Archive. In 2022, Mayor Andrew Ginther declared gun violence a public health crisis, placing it on par with COVID-19. COVID is no longer an emergency, but it exposed large societal rifts and left psychological scars. Gun violence may follow the same path. Even as it recedes, neighborhoods like the one near Walnut Hill Park may never feel as secure as they once did. Some criminologists say there is no reason to think that homicides cannot fall back to the relatively low level seen in the 20 years before the pandemic, except perhaps that there are far more guns and far fewer limits on them. Adonis, a 14-year-old in Columbus whose life was upended by the pandemic, is skeptical. "The government, or whatever, already let too many guns go around the whole entire city," he said. "They should have been stopping this when they had the chance to. I feel like it's too late now." For more than a decade, the Ohio legislature had been scaling back gun regulations. In 2006, lawmakers preempted cities from passing their own gun statutes. In 2014, they rescinded a ban on high-capacity magazines. Then, in 2019, a gunman in Dayton used one to fire 41 rounds in under 30 seconds, killing 9 people and wounding 17. The outcry that followed prompted Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, to promise changes that included expanded background checks and a red flag law allowing for the temporary removal of guns from people deemed dangerous to themselves or others. The proposals went nowhere. Instead, in 2020, the state enacted a Stand Your Ground law supported by gun rights organizations, expanding established limits on when a shooting can be deemed self-defense. In 2022, Ohio lawmakers allowed school boards to arm teachers who completed 24 hours of training, eliminated permit and training requirements for concealed weapons, and barred cities from prohibiting gun sales during riots. Proponents of expansive gun rights argue that increased regulation only makes it harder for lawful buyers to obtain guns for legitimate reasons, and that criminals will always find ways to skirt stricter laws. In Ohio, Republican supporters for the permitless carry bill said that there was little difference between openly carrying a gun, which Ohioans are permitted to do, and concealing that same weapon. Killers, rapists, kidnappers, and other violent criminals don't obey this law anyway, said State Representatives Tom Brinkman and Chris Jordan, the bill's sponsors, in their written testimony. Facing a mounting body count in 2021 and 22, Columbus tried to test the state ban on local lawmaking. The city enacted legislation requiring guns to be safely stored around children and banning high-capacity magazines, but the measures were stalled by court challenges, one by the state attorney general, a Republican, and the other by private citizens. Columbus, in turn, has challenged the 2023 state law that prohibits cities from halting the sale of guns and ammunition during riots. I feel like at times we have one or two arms tied behind our back trying to fight gun violence, said Mayor Ginther, a Democrat, who just began his third term. And it can be very frustrating because the people are angry. They want more to be done. Guns have become a feature of life for Adonis and his friend Jason, who are both in eighth grade. We see them every single day, Adonis said, but at this point, it don't even faze us. Adonis and Jason described how their life had changed dramatically since the onset of the pandemic. When we were younger, it was like, you can walk out and do anything. Like, it's fun outside, Jason said. Now you walk out, you gotta be worried about getting shot. Both boys, whom the Times is identifying only by their first names, had agreed to an interview to talk about their friend Teron Durham, a music-loving, witty 13-year-old who had been fatally shot in December. But the conversation ranged widely, hinting at some of the reasons violence has spread among young people. The boys said that boredom and lack of supervision during the pandemic had given rise to a wave of Kia boys, or children as young as 10 or 11, who learned to steal Kias and Hyundais by watching how-to videos. Stolen cars gave youths, even those well below legal driving age, the means to travel beyond their own neighborhoods. In Columbus, auto thefts more than doubled between 2019 and 2023, and stolen cars have been involved in a host of dangerous incidents, including high-speed chases and drive-by shootings. Cars also became a focus for break-ins, with thieves increasingly finding handguns among their spoils. Between 2017 and 2021, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms says more than 1 million guns were reported stolen from private individuals nationally. Stolen guns in Columbus might be had for as little as $50, according to law enforcement officials. Before, you could knock on the door of your neighbor and get some weed, said Janae Patrick, a member of Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children, an anti-violence group. That's how you get guns now. It's that easy. Though Jason and Adonis said they were spending less time on the streets, their Instagram feeds are still full of images of children posing with handguns, as well as RIP, rest in peace posts for gun victims. One of the boys' handles includes the initials FTO, a profane swipe at their ops or rivals. Back and forth dissing on social media is common but dangerous, sometimes leading to a retaliation in real life. Because of that threat, Jason and Adonis explained, people carry guns to protect themselves and, Jason added, just to show off. Social media, of course, knows no geographic boundaries, and people who are miles apart can feud while unwittingly posting clues to their whereabouts. Almost any case I have that's a murder, aggravated robbery, felonious assault with a shooting, when we get the phone dumps, there's stuff with them posing with guns or threatening to do harm to people. It's a constant, said Euripides Chimidis, a prosecutor who handles juvenile cases in Columbus. In my view, they're putting themselves at risk, making other kids want to come after them. As gun violence intensified and spread in Columbus, communities long plagued by violence got far worse. Trayvon Dixon, 15, and living on the east side of the city near the Barnett Recreation Center, personally knew almost two dozen people who had been killed, according to his mother, Shauna Brady. Trayvon was home on April 20th, 2021, when after a day of virtual classes, he arranged by text to have marijuana delivered to the apartment. When a minivan pulled up outside with the pot, Trayvon ventured out to collect it. Within seconds, the driver, another 15-year-old, shot at him, a witness told the police. Trayvon pulled out a revolver and returned fire, the witness said. The other teen was hit in the leg, while Trayvon was hit twice in the chest, bleeding to death while his cousin rushed him to a hospital. The other teen, who pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter in the juvenile court, has maintained through his lawyer that he acted in self-defense. Ms. Brady insists her son could not have been the aggressor, but Ms. Brady, who cares for mental health patients, admits that she knew that Trayvon had a gun. I work a lot. I work around the clock, and he was my protector, she said. He protected the house. If she had to do it over, she said, she would have not allowed it. We see this all the time, said Melissa Thomas St. Clair, a middle school teacher who in August 2020 learned that one of her former students, a 14-year-old, had shot and killed his 2-year-old nephew while playing with a revolver. With an anguished post on Facebook, she founded the Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children. The organization has made parental accountability a key part of its message. Ms. Thomas St. Clair said, in part because the attitude that the man of the family should be armed, even if he is still a child, is not uncommon. Every one of us has a story of if there was better accountability within our parenting, then maybe some decisions of our children would have been different, she said. Ms. Thomas St. Clair's own adult son was fatally stabbed in 2013 while trying to collect on a drug debt. In their matching camo outfits, members of the Mothers of Murdered Columbus Children have been visible supporters of the city's effort to combat gun violence. Columbus has tried a host of strategies, including gun buybacks, youth programs, increased funding for domestic violence shelters, and more detectives devoted to shootings. The sharp decline in homicides this year is an encouraging sign, but officials say they are up against a tidal wave of guns. In 2020, there were 11.3 million guns manufactured in the United States for domestic consumption, more than twice the number produced in 2010, according to the ATF. There are also signs that more guns are vanishing from the legal market. Between 2017 and 2021, the percentage of guns recovered from crimes that had been purchased within the previous year steadily increased, according to ATF data. A short time to crime can indicate an illegal straw purchase intended to evade background checks, minimum age laws, and other safeguards. Walnut Hills Park Drive still has its broad front lawns, backyard play forts, and late model pickups parked in circular drives. But much has changed on the block since Father's Day in 2021. Ms. Key's grandparents, Verna and Cordell Williams, caught COVID-19 and died 3 months after their grandson-in-law was killed. Elias Smith, the former Marine who shot Mr. Keyes, no longer lives in his mother's basement. He is serving 15 years to life for murder. His trial included evidence that he has both PTSD and a traumatic brain injury. Robert Thomas, the neighbor who instigated the episode with his rifle, was acquitted of an involuntary manslaughter charge, but convicted of aggravated menacing. He was placed on house arrest at his daughter's home and ordered to stay away from the block. Ms. Keyes, who was wounded by shrapnel in the shooting that killed her husband, is still recovering both physically and mentally. She and her husband had both known victims of gun violence. That was one reason they lived in a high-security apartment complex, went to work, went to church, and tried to stay out of the way, she said. It was not enough. Now we have people walking around who are just ticking time bombs, Ms. Keyes said. I've done enough in my power to keep me from violence, but it's chasing me. Okay, so we have a little bit of time left. This article is titled, Trump Courtroom Plays Host to Nonstop Spectacle as Prosecution Rests. Michael D. Cohen admitted stealing from the Trump Organization. The judge excoriated a defense witness. And Donald J. Trump's entourage included a former leader of the Hell's Angels. This article is by Jonah E. Brumwich, Ben Protas, and Maggie Haberman. On a pivotal day in the first criminal trial of an American president, the courtroom threatened to spin out of control. The prosecution's star witness, Michael D. Cohen, admitted on the stand to stealing from former President Donald J. Trump's company. Mr. Trump's courtroom entourage included three supporters charged with felonies of their own, and the defense's only real witness was so defiant that the judge, after excoriating him, cleared the courtroom. The trial's first 5 weeks featured dramatic descriptions of sex and scandal, and the final phase of testimony on Monday showed no signs of a let-up, as the courtroom played host to a nonstop spectacle. The tension came to a head after the prosecution rested its case and the defense called its witness, Robert J. Costello, a lawyer who had once advised Mr. Cohen. The defense saw Mr. Costello as a foil to Mr. Cohen, Mr. Trump's one-time personal lawyer and longtime henchman. But the strategy may not have paid off. The judge promptly lost his patience with Mr. Costello, a prosecutor-turned-defense lawyer and fixture in New York's legal world. When Mr. Costello scoffed at one of the judge's rulings, "Geez," he said, before mumbling a retraction, the judge grew irate. Excusing the jury, the judge, Juan M. Merchant, lectured Mr. Costello, "If you don't like my ruling, you don't say geez, and you don't say strike it, because I'm the only one who can strike testimony in court," he said, adding, "Are you staring me down?" He ordered the court cleared, briefly ejecting reporters and other onlookers while allowing Mr. Trump's supporters to remain. When those told to leave did so, according to a transcript, he told Mr. Costello that his conduct was contemptuous and said, "If you try to stare me down one more time, I will remove you from the stand," adding to the defense lawyers, "I will strike his testimony. Do you hear me?" The explosion overshadowed the performance from Mr. Cohen, who on his fourth and final day on the stand fended off a fuselage of attacks from the defense. He was the only witness to offer firsthand evidence directly linking Mr. Trump to the records that underpin the charges against him. Mr. Trump, he said, approved a plan to falsify the records to cover up a sex scandal involving a porn star. And that is all that we have time for today. Coming to you from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, this is Cindy. Thank you so much for listening.